the book of Job, Understanding Suffering by Robert C. Newman. Brief abstract of this talk. Book of Job is helpful in understanding cases of apparently inexplicable suffering. Here we look at the plot of the book and draw a number of lessons from it. Most of us have faced examples or experienced examples of inexplicable suffering. Perhaps a loved one has had a long, painful illness before dying. And we wondered, why was it a long, painful illness? Why didn't the person die right away? Why didn't the Lord take them home? Perhaps we see a young person who is cut off in the prime of life and say, what a loss. Why didn't this person live to accomplish great things? Or perhaps we ourselves experience suffering that seems purposeless. Usually when you're in the middle of some kind of pain, it's not very pleasant. And we can certainly imagine how we could, how it would be better not to be going through something of that sort. Well, the book of Job, I think, is helpful in understanding some of the most difficult cases. While we're not going to discuss difficult cases here, we want to tour through the book of Job and think about some of the lessons it provides. So we look first of all at the plot of Job. How the book begins, well, we're told a little about Job's circumstances. We're told he's the most righteous person on earth in his day. Well, there's a lot bigger population on the earth today, and we've learned certainly some more about God's law and what he's done in Jesus and that sort of thing. But there's really no reason to think that our day is much better, that somehow the Job is the most righteous person on earth and his day is way worse than we are. Job is also very wealthy. He has a happy family. See that, and the kids want to get together with one another. We also get God's evaluation of Job in the beginning of the book. God says there's no one on earth like him. But then we also get Satan's response. Satan says, ha, Job is well paid to be good. Take his wealth away, and he will curse you to your face. Well, that in some sense lays the groundwork then for the major plot of the book. Will Job curse God to his face if these things are taken away? God permits a test to see whether Satan's challenge is warranted. Chapter 1 gives us the first test. Satan takes away Job's wealth and Job's children. Satan also timed the arrival of messengers from these various disasters to build the impact. We see kind of a scary picture of what Satan is able to do in this world. And we see that God allows it in this particular case. But Job doesn't curse God. Chapter 2 brings us to the second test. Satan is not about to admit he is wrong. He just raises the stakes. He says, well, Job will curse you if his health is taken away. And God permits that now. So now Satan takes away Job's health, and Satan takes away the support of Job's wife. We see in both cases, Satan is pushing the envelope. Satan said, take away his wealth, and God permits it, and Satan takes away Job's wealth, but also his children. Now he says, let me take away his health, and God permits it, and Job's health is taken away by Satan, but also the support of his wife. But still, Job doesn't curse God. What about the rest of the book? That's just chapters 1 and 2. Why are there nearly 40 more chapters? Why chapters 3 through 42? Wouldn't the message be clearer with just a chapter or so on Job's friends, plus another with for the interview with God? Well, don't know. Perhaps the length of that is to give the reader a little feel for the length of Job's distress. That's a possibility. But it looks to me like God continues the test to take away things that Satan didn't take away in the first two tests. We're not really sure what part Satan plays in this, because we don't see any more of Satan. But here's the things that are taken away. Not only has Job lost his wealth and his children and his health and the support of his wife, but now in these chapters 3 through 42, other things are taken away. The support of Job's friends, Eliphaz, Bildad, Zophar, these are good friends. You go back and look at what they do in the opening chapters there, and they're good enough friends that they actually come to Job in the midst of this disaster, when most of Job's friends and relatives, etc., are running from Job by the time that he's had these disasters. They feel it's dangerous to be in his presence, lest another disaster strike. Well, Eliphaz and Bildad and Zophar come to Job, and then they sit there silently commiserating with Job for a week before they begin to speak up. And yet, not more than a few more chapters are gone, and Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar are blaming Job for Job's troubles. But finally, they lapse into silence. And then this other fellow, Elihu, speaks up, a younger fellow than Job's friends, and apparently not specifically a friend of Job, though it must be a neighbor or somebody that's nearby. And as we listen to Elihu's arguments, it's interesting that they resonate with God's arguments later on at the end of the book, and it sounds like Job is losing the support of being right in this whole situation with Elihu. And then finally, God shows up as we get near the end of the book, chapter 38 and following, and God doesn't pat Job on the back either. God accuses Job, and so Job loses the support of God as well. So by the time we've gotten up to near the end of the book, Job has lost his wealth and his children and his health and the support of his wife and the support of his friends and the support of being right and the support of God. When God finally does appear in chapter 38, Job doesn't curse him. Job instead comes to see his own sins and repents. And then we reach the climax of the book. Well, if we find it hard to imagine ourselves doing what Job does, I suggest that this just shows we aren't in Job's league in the area of righteousness, which is, after all, what the book claims. Huh? But when Job does come to see his own sins and repents, then God praises Job, even though Job has said things he shouldn't have said. And God rebukes Job's friends, even though Job's friends were trying hard to defend God. That's surely what they're doing in their earlier remarks. The point here, I think, is that Job remained relatively faithful under far more difficult circumstances than his friends faced. And since God is obviously right about Job being the most righteous person in his generation, his friends would have not done nearly so well. And finally, and this ruins the story for many liberal commentators, God gives Job double what he had lost. By the way, if you were Job, this wouldn't ruin the story. Well, let us look at the book then and see what lessons we can learn from it. Some lessons from Job. I'm going to suggest our first lesson is what I call the two worlds. As readers of the book of Job, we have a great advantage over Job and his friends. What's that? We can see what's happening in the unseen world. The world of Satan, the world where God is, the invisible spirit world, if you like. They can't see that. Job's friends don't see this other world. And so, when they seek to defend God, which they know is right, and it is, they wind up attacking Job, inventing a secret sin theory, because they can't see the invisible world inside Job's head and know that, in fact, he is the most righteous person living on earth and is far better than they are. And so, to defend God, they attack Job. And to do this, they invent a secret sin theory, which they've got no evidence for, except their theory about what God ought to do. Their theology, and Satan's, by the way, is rather disturbingly like today's health and wealth gospel. If you do the right things, everything will go well. If you just have enough faith, you'll get health and wealth. Well, Job did the right things better than anybody in his generation, and this disaster came. And Job certainly had trust in God, and this disaster came. And the reason this happened is that the health and wealth gospel is false. It does not take account of what God is actually doing in history. Job, of course, doesn't see the unseen world either. He knows God allowed these things to happen because he does understand that much about what the world is about and who God is. And Job is right about this, whether he knows about Satan or not. We don't know how much knowledge Job had of the existence and attributes of Satan. Job also knows that his friend's accusations are false. After all, one part of the unseen world that Job can see, that his friends can't, is what's inside his own head. He knows what he has done. He knows he's a sinner, but he also knows he's trying hard to be faithful to God. He knows that the friend's accusations of mistreating the poor in all instances are in fact false. And the result of that is that Job's friends preaching to him and counseling him actually tends to drive Job away from God rather than towards repentance. We need to be very careful in our preaching and counseling, lest by misdiagnosis of some particular situation, we wind up driving people away from God, who, although they may not know some things we know some things about themselves, may know some things about the world around them that we don't know. And by trying to give them a choice between their view and our view, they wind up rejecting our view and our God, even though we believe in the right God, but we've got something messed up about our view. Now, having said this about the two worlds, that we as readers have an advantage over Job and his friends, because we as readers can see this other world and can see the Satan meeting with God and what the arrangement is and what Satan's charge is and such and what he's doing, that only applies to the book of Job. Outside the book of Job, we don't see this unseen world either. So the question is, when something disastrous happens to one of our friends, will we respond to that person like Job's friends responded to him? Or if something disastrous happened to us, will we respond like Job does in his worst moments? Or will we respond like Job does in his better moments? Will we cling to God and trust him for vindication in his time? There's another lesson I think we can learn from the two worlds, and that is, by looking at what's going on here, we see that the loss of the wealth that took place in Job's life, the loss of his health, the loss of his children, the loss of the support of his wife, etc., that these are actually persecutions from Satan. And we might generalize that then to suggest that apparently much inexplicable suffering is really persecution from Satan. Maybe all of it is. Now, when we see someone that we know hates God, and we see them doing something to us or some other believer, we say that's persecution. And of course, that's easier to handle in some ways than inexplicable suffering is. It may still be very tough to handle, but it's easier to handle. But if we realize that perhaps much, and maybe even all, of inexplicable suffering is actually persecution, and it's persecution from Satan, then we should not let it drive us away from God, because in that case it will be driving us into the arms of the one who is actually the persecutor. Well, we move away from the question of the two worlds then, and look at Job's response. Though Satan claimed that Job served God for what he got out of it, Job and his friends come to see that Job served God because of who God is. I don't know whether Job realized that in advance or not, but that is a very, very basic thing. God is worthy of our worship, whether we get anything for it or not. Besides Job, two of the more spectacular examples of this are Moses and Paul. Moses asked God to curse him, destroy him, rather than bringing disaster on Israel. God would not do it. Paul prayed that he might be accursed, rather than that Israel might not be saved. And God wouldn't do it either. But in both of those cases, we see that Moses and Paul's concern for the integrity of God, concern for God's reputation, concern for God's promises, were strong enough that they were willing to suffer a great loss rather than see something like that happen. Well, God is worthy of our worship whether we get anything for it or not. We see some little examples of that in our own lives that we ought to be able to apply to this whole matter of God. Occasionally, we're at a basketball game, and of course we're rooting for the home team, our home team, but one of the opponent's players is really a spectacular player, and we have to admire him for this or that play he makes, even though it's not to our advantage. We're impressed by that person's ability. Perhaps, on the other hand, we're at a concert of some sort, and the performer there, we won't say whether it's an opera star, a classical music performer of some sort, a violinist or such, or whether it's a rock musician, that person is so good that we admire the person for those abilities. Well, God is so good, he is so wise, that he is worthy of our worship, whether or not we will get anything out of it or not. Do we serve God for who he is, or do we serve him for what we can get out of it? If we serve him for what we can get out of it, that means we are very vulnerable to this or that disaster coming into our lives. Now, we can't guarantee that we will be vulnerable to some disaster. We don't know how we will perform in some difficult circumstance. We can imagine that we'll do quite well. We're really quite good at that, by the way. We should pray to God that he would cause us to love him with all our heart and mind and soul and strength. We should pray to God that he will keep us in whatever circumstances he brings us through. And if we do that, the Lord will certainly do that for us. What about Satan's response? Well, Satan clears out before the end. We really don't hear anything about him after chapter 2. Satan is defeated, but he's not about to admit it. Satan won't admit it till the very end, when every knee will bow and every tongue will confess that Jesus is Lord to the glory of God the Father. Well, we aren't there yet, so don't expect vindication in this life. We may get vindication here and now. Job eventually did in this life, but we may not. So, don't count on it. Count on God. God's response, Job's response, Satan's response, God's response. Well, for God, it's important that Job not know what is happening. Of course, Job knows that he's lost his wealth, and he's lost his children, and he's lost his health, and he's lost the support of his wife, and he's losing the support of his three friends, and the support of being right. And then when God comes, he sees that God is accusing him as well. Mm. It's important that God not know what is happening, that this is a test brought on by Satan's charge. Otherwise, this won't be the right kind of test. It'll just be a test of endurance, like you know you're under persecution, and so you're just enduring, rather than you're under a test to see whether you really care about God more than anything else in the world. God then cannot intervene to bail Job out, or the test will be invalidated. Well, I suspect God has intervened many, many times in history to bail other people out and to bail us out, and therefore invalidated some test that otherwise might have been a very good one for us to have gone through. Mm-hmm. But God cannot intervene to bail Job out, or the test will be invalidated. And God then goes beyond Satan's charges to take away everything from Job. Job's wealth, his children, his health, his support of his wife, his support of his three friends, his support of being right, and finally, the support of God. Once Job has seen God and admitted God's charges and worshipped God, the test is over, and Job has passed. God then praises Job and humbles Job's friends. Also, as we look in the last chapter there, we'll see that Job's other friends come back, and they congratulate him and console him and bring some money and things of that sort. Great friends, huh? But in the kind of world we're in, lots of our friends are going to be like that. They're going to like us, but they aren't going to risk too much for us. God's response, he praises Job, humbles his friends, Job's other friends come back, and then God gives Job double what he lost. God gives Job two times the wealth he had before, and he gives him the same number more children. Some commentators have pointed out that he doesn't give him twice as many children, because Job has not finally lost those other children. Because humans, unlike some other things, don't cease to exist when they die. And we will meet those other people who died, if they're believers, in the age to come. God gives Job double what he lost, as I said, ruining the story for some liberal commentators, because God is no cheapskate. Though we serve God for nothing, God will not send us away empty-handed. He is not cheap. But the full reward cannot come till the test is over. Well, what's our response going to be? Well, we should pay attention in the book of Job. We should realize we're experiencing similar things. Probably none of us have experienced as bad as Job does, but it's all right. We're experiencing the unseen world. We're experiencing Satan's attacks. We're experiencing the same God. God doesn't change. Our friends are watching too. We're experiencing similar things. The same unseen world. Attacks from the same Satan. The same God over it all. And our friends watching too. May the Lord help us then to be faithful in the midst of such circumstances and to realize that we won't be able to explain all suffering in detail, but we're probably not going to be far off the mark when we realize that inexplicable suffering is the work of Satan at one level, and that God is using that to purify us, to draw him to ourselves. May we trust him for that. Well, that's the end of this talk, but that's not the end. Not yet. Therefore, be steadfast, unmovable, always abounding, for your labor is not in vain in the Lord.